я еду, и я буду встречаться с...
My message is that the position...
Если Путин захочет, и тогда можно будет участвовать.
Борис Титов продолжает кампанию в защиту российских предпринимателей. В списке 16 человек.
One candidate for Russia's presidency hits the campaign trail in Washington. Another talks about taking a job as a Kremlin advisor after the election. Yet another says he negotiated a deal to bring exiled Russian businessmen and their money back home. And one non-candidate releases a salacious video featuring an oligarch, a top official, a yacht, and an escort worker. Welcome to the weird, weird world of Russia's so-called presidential election. Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFURL. Joining me here in the studio is veteran journalist and Kremlin watcher Kirill Suchotsky, executive editor of RFURL's Russian language television program, Current Time. Welcome back, Kirill.
Hi, Brian.
So, the Central Election Commission announced this week that 8 candidates, Vladimir Putin and 7 sacrificial lambs, have been qualified for the ballot in the event on March 18th that the Kremlin insists on calling an election. And surprise, surprise, the pro-Kremlin polling agency FTSOM released a survey suggesting that the Putin regime is on track to achieve its stated 70-70 goal, 70% turnout and 70% for Putin. Well, wonders
and
never
Putin, Putin will be 70 soon, too.
And Putin will be 70 in 5 years or so, right? But what grabbed my attention this week were the activities of the so-called opposition candidates. We'll leave non-candidate Alexei Navalny's salacious video for the second half of the program. But let's look at the other, in quotes, opposition candidates and what they've been doing and what this reveals. Let's start with Ksenia Sobchak. She spent the last week in Washington. She spoke at the Center for Strategic International Studies. She attended the National Prayer Breakfast. She gave an interview to CNN, to Christiane Amanpour, and she berated American journalists for referring to her as Russia's Paris Hilton. Kirill, why is Sobchak in the United States?
Why is she running for president? Why is she in the United States? It seems she has been more on screen from the United States this week than she has been on screen from the campaign in Russia. So it almost somebody joked that is she running for the president of the United States or what? It's very interesting that because this is not the election, so you don't need really to appeal to your electorate, to your base. There is no base. What she's doing is kind of she's promoting, she's appealing to the international public opinion. Because as many believe, she's not kind of the candidate of the Kremlin, but she was the candidate, or she is the candidate that the Kremlin is very enthusiastic about, and nobody knows whether it's her idea to run and whether she was suggested to run. But it is a candidate that the Kremlin likes. Mm-hmm. She made some slips through in her interviews in the United States. One of them, she said that Putin needs an exit strategy. She said that Putin is, this is his last term, this is his last 6 years, and then he needs an exit strategy, but that exit strategy should be something he's comfortable with. And she said, I think I am is the person he would be comfortable with.
You think she
with.
Was off script there?
I think she was, as in many. She is a socialite. She is a Big Brother host in Russia.
But she's a very intelligent woman.
She is, and she's educated, and she's intelligent, but she can speak off the script and make unwarranted remarks. She did not suggest at any point that she was, hired by the presidential administration or made a deal with the presidential administration, but her message was, I can be one element of Putin's succession. Or transition of power whenever it happens in the future.
She's trying to thread the needle here, doing what the Kremlin wants and basically trying to sell herself.
I think so. And what she does, because this is not the election, the purpose of this election is to give Putin legitimacy for another 6 years. And that legitimacy is not about, sometimes it's not about his legitimacy in Russia, and that you told about the 70-70 goal, but also about his legitimacy in the court of the public opinion.
Right.
and that's exactly what she's doing.
So she's got a mission here. I mean, she's this got is a Kremlin-sanctioned
First of
thing.
All, she, you know, to present, to tell the world that, okay, Putin is about to go at some point in the future, so let's not forget about that. She also puts a human face on, you know, on the Russian elite, mm-hmm. which she's a part of. And the third and more important, she creates an image that this is actually an election. Mm-hmm. She is introduced as a candidate of the Russian in the Russian elections. Mm-hmm. So it's some candidate that the world expects from an election. Mm-hmm. She looks like a candidate who could run in any other election. To the West, okay. It's not just Putin, it's somebody else.
Right.
And somebody else who's articulate, who's an English speaker, who can answer difficult question, who is appealing towards the American audience. So this is a PR campaign, not of Ksenia Sobchak. This is a PR campaign of legitimacy of the Russian election.
Now, in areas where she was kind of straying from the Kremlin line, on Crimea, for example, she said it's pretty clear that Russia interfered in the U.S. elections and that this is unacceptable. On one hand, she's doing stuff like that. On the other hand, she seems to be delivering Kremlin talking points. Don't isolate Russia. This is dangerous. It could destabilize the situation. She said that several different times. In her talk at CSIS, she said that part of the problem right now is that the West rejected Russia after the fall of the Soviet Union. The Russia should have been able to join the European Union, which is like me saying, oh, I should be able to play center forward for Manchester United, even though I'm clearly not qualified to do so. So she was repeating Kremlin talking points here. But on the other hand, she was like not repeating Kremlin talking points. She was going exactly the opposite. How do you explain that?
I think because her strategy is two-pronged. First of all, she needs to deliver a message from the Kremlin to the West, and she was chosen to be that messenger. She's the only one amongst those seven sacrificial lambs who can actually talk to the West, mm-hmm. In the same language. And I'm not talking about English language; it's about kind of the same mindset.
Yeah, no, she's very poised and presents herself very well.
But the second is kind of to tell the West what they want to hear. Whatever points she made about Crimea, about something else...
Interference in the election.
Yeah, interference in the election. It's not for the Russian audience. The Russian audience will not even find out about them. So this is for the Western audience to see, okay, this is somebody who's acceptable, who's reasonable, and who is actually kind of thinking as we do. But on the other hand, her message was to tell the world that don't be too nervous and don't be too hysterical about this particular election because Putin will go.
And don't isolate Russia.
Because that will end soon. So I think she is, that conveyor of the message is just don't do something, don't go to mental war with Russia or mental war with Putin because Putin will be gone soon. Mm-hmm. And that way, she is there to calm the waters and say, okay, bear with us. Bear with Russia, bear with Putin's elite. So I think that's why she's there.
Now, Sobchak wasn't the only candidate who's been spending time abroad. Boris Titov, the Kremlin's ombudsman for entrepreneurs' rights, says he held private meetings with exiled Russian businessmen in London last weekend, and then gave journalists the names of 16 of them he said wanted to return to the country in exchange for amnesty. This is kind of an odd thing for a candidate for the presidency of the Russian Federation to be doing, even though this isn't really an election. Was this a campaign stunt, an errand for the Kremlin? What's this all about?
Yeah, I think it's, and he's not a real candidate either. He was one of the first to announce his run
for
president.
For the Kremlin.
Yeah, he works for the Kremlin, and that's again the strategy, but that's for internal consumption. I think that's for, because he's been propped up, he's everywhere on Russian state television as a business. So he's kind of a Prokhorov light, if you remember Mikhail Prokhorov, who represented business environment and something else. So what he's doing here is kind of he presents a message to the public. He actually plays Putin's hand. He tells Russians, okay, things are so great in Russia that even those people who fled, they're keen to return. Mm-hmm. I looked at that list of the 16. There is maybe one or two names that I can recognize, but mm-hmm. there are much, much bigger people and much bigger fish who fled to the UK mm-hmm. and who will not return. We're speaking to them. We're doing a series of interviews this week, actually, in London. We are speaking to Mikhail Khodorkovsky, former Yukosa owner. We're speaking to Yevgeny Chichvarkin, former telecoms magnate. We're speaking to Boris Akunin, one of Russia's mm-hmm. most important writers, and others and others. None of them is on that list. None of them are coming back to Russia. And they are household names, right. Unlike those 16 that this bogus list contains.
Well, the political commentator Tatiana Stanovaya, who's actually one of my favorite commentators on Russian affairs, had a good piece in Republic.ru this week about this, where she made the argument that this is all kind of absurd, because if you protect property rights in Russia, that means the end of this regime.
Yeah.
This regime is based on cronyism, corruption, kleptocracy, and patron-client relationships. You cannot protect property rights in that situation. These businessmen that have fled, yeah, ostensibly they have fled for politicized criminal cases against them. But what they really fled was the fact that property rights aren't protected in Russia, and, you know, strange things that happen in Russia to unconnected people who think they own property.
And it's very interesting that there was a very prompt response of Putin's spokesman Dmitry Peskov to that letter. And then you know that it was choreographed, because if it was not warranted, then it wouldn't get, you know, usually Peskov says, oh, I've never read the letter. Mm. Oh, I have not seen that. Or it's not my area of expertise, or it's not my business altogether. So he promptly commented on that letter and said, yeah, we would like them to return. And I can tell them that they are much more protected in Russia by laws than by the presidential administration. But that's exactly why they left.
Right, right.
Because
right.
the laws cannot protect them.
Along these
because
lines.
Because laws were used to actually prosecute them on, you know, bogus charges.
I don't know if you saw the hilarious mashup that Medusa did this week of Putin saying "в рамках закона" over and over and over and over again, his favorite phrase in the framework of the law. But you just made me think about that there. Now, then there is Grigory Yavlinsky. Now, somebody I've been following kind of closely since the 90s. And somebody who I do believe in his heart of hearts of hearts is truly a liberal, right? But again, a perennial presidential candidate who knows this is a farce and continues to participate in it. Last week, reports surfaced that Yavlinsky was in talks with the Kremlin about taking a job as an advisor on Ukraine, replacing Vladislav Surkov. After the election, nobody's rushed out to deny these reports. Yavlinsky says he's been in talks. It's kind of odd, because if you look at Yavlinsky's campaign program, it's talking about renouncing the illegal annexation of Crimea, stopping the aggressive war against Ukraine. Are they really consider what?
Yeah, but
what is
you know,
about?
In Russia, whatever people say and whatever people do are two different things.
Yes,
but the with Yavlinsky, Navalny makes a point of accusing him of being in the pocket of the Kremlin, mm-hmm. and that he was kind of a pocket opposition that helped Putin to stay in power. If one can make a comparison, there is a token American political scientist that is a guest on pretty much every Russian political talk
right.
show called Michael Baum, which is pretty much a punching bag
right.
with an American name. So this is something, you know, more or less the same on the political stage. It's very interesting that if we compare the 2012 elections and 2018 elections, when Yavlinsky collected his signatures in 2012 with the same level of organization, when he submitted those signatures to the Central Electoral Commission, the Central Electoral Commission, who was not too happy about Yavlinsky on the back of popular mass protests mm-hmm. In Moscow, they found that 20% of signatures were fake.
Mm-hmm.
And now in 2018, none of them are fake.
Uh-huh. So what is Yavlinsky being kind of groomed to being brought into the system in some way? Is this talk of him potentially taking a Kremlin job after the election if he plays his role properly?
There was a talk before that in return for whatever Javlinsky does, or being liberal but not too far advanced or too radical liberal, or not going as far as to call people in the streets like Navalny does, then Yabloko will get a decent percentage of the vote, which will get them state financing throughout the next political cycle. We'll see how many votes Yabloko and Javlinsky will get at these elections, but many people disappointed and disenfranchised because the talking points from Javlinsky have not changed pretty much over the past 20 years.
No, he's remarkably consistent.
And now you have more energetic candidates like even Sobchak, like Grudinin. Like Navalny, who's not taking part, but is still a figure that looming large over this election.
Right. Now, Yabloko is the oldest existing liberal party in Russia. And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, other than the communists, the oldest continuously existing party in post-Soviet Russia. There have been rumors in the last couple Duma elections that they were going to be allowed into the Duma. You saw Javlinsky suddenly getting airtime on state television, which doesn't happen by accident. But then they keep not getting in, right?
It was interesting. RFRL did an interview with Javlinsky. Was it last week when he couldn't pronounce the surname Navalny the same way as Putin does.
Putin doesn't say the name Navalny.
Exactly. And Javlinsky was actually prompted by the host actively to say Navalny. Because he was saying personage. He used the same word as Putin does. You know, some like a person or a character. And then the host prompted him and said, no. We're speaking about Navalny, correct? Can you say Navalny? And only then Javlinsky, as in defiance, said, okay, I will pronounce that, Navalny.
Uh-huh. Interesting. Now, I keep coming back to this. This whole idea of him being an advisor on Ukraine and replacing Surkov is a bit bizarre. Why this?
It is.
Stanovaya had another piece where she said, this isn't as far-fetched as you think if Russia wants to find a face-saving way out of Ukraine. But, I mean, somebody that's called for the renunciation of the illegal annexation of Crimea, or the illegal unification. He didn't use the annexation
word.
Yeah,
there are two schools of thoughts on what will happen.
He was born in Ukraine.
Yeah, in East Ukraine after the election. One school of thought believes that Russia wants to kind of close this chapter and move on. And another school of thought says that actually things will get worse before they get better.
Right.
And I was in Kyiv last week, and I was surprised by how many people are talking about a big war starting later this year.
They're always talking about that in Kyiv.
Yeah, I know. But the thing is, to do any meaningful closing the chapter and moving on, and to, you know, to do some meaningful sort of a deal, there should be a person on the Russian side who will be treated seriously and responsibly by the Ukrainian side. And Javlinsky could be that person.
He could be that person, although he's not going to be taken like somebody who's Surkov, whose people know has juice in the Kremlin. Where Javlinsky, they're going to be always thinking, does this guy really have any influence? You know, and that was one of the things that would have given me pause. But we'll see how that works out. Javlinsky's playing his role here. Finally, there's communist candidate Pavel Grudinin, who the BBC this week creatively called the strawberry candidate. He was once a member of United Russia. He's allegedly been rising in the polls, and he's been subject to attacks by the Kremlin media. Like I said, he's been called the strawberry candidate because he's the boss of a large collective farm outside of Moscow that is Russia's largest strawberry producer. Very odd. Communist.
Yeah, a strawberry tech. But he's not even a member of the Communist Party.
No, he's not. He was a member of United Russia.
Yeah, so he is a candidate of the Communist Party without even being a communist. And many people, and he's been propped up as actually a liberal communist or some kind of a liberal in disguise, sort of a Javlinsky who can appeal for a wider audience.
Or kind of like Kwasniewski after communism in Poland.
Yeah, so it's kind of somebody who's kind of more social democrat than he is a communist, and somebody who is can appeal to a wider base, who can appeal to a liberal audience, who can appeal to a communist audience. Actually, I know, and I know some of my friends in Moscow who are of younger generation, who will vote for Grudinin. Mm-hmm. So because he is seen as a businessman, he is seen as a liberal, you know, sort of a liberal, more liberal than Putin, not as compromised as Sobchak, not as deadwood as Yavlinsky. Mm-hmm. So Grudinin is that candidate. It is very interesting. Yesterday I spoke to somebody in Moscow who has connections with the presidential administration. That person told me that the presidential administration is a bit alarmed by rising polls of Grudinin.
Well, this is what was interesting, because there were attacks in the state media on him as he was rising. Now, my first instinct, you can't watch Russia for as long as we have and not be completely cynical and think everything is pakazuka. Right. So I saw this going on. I see, okay, Grudinin's numbers are going up. Not to the point where they're threatening anybody, but they're going up. And, interesting. Russian state TV is attacking them. This is pakazuka. They're creating the illusion of a competition. But you're saying they're actually alarmed, and that's interesting.
They're alarmed. And I don't know to what extent, you know, again, one should take everything with a pinch of salt. But what I was told yesterday is there are two competing factions in the presidential administration. One competing faction says, one of the faction that probably is prevailing and is the bigger one, but they want to go for 70-70. They want to go to let things go the way they go now. And apparently there is a second section, the second faction in the presidential administration, that wants, you know, okay, we need to create something else. Let Grudinin go to the second round.
To the second round? Putin has never gone to the second round.
I know, and that's why I laughed
even
out loud.
Even in his first election.
But, you know, if Grudinin is given airtime and something else, then that can be a possibility.
That's dangerous. I mean, for them.
Exactly. and it's dangerous for lame duck Putin. It's dangerous for his legitimacy.
It makes him look like even more of a lame duck.
Yeah, as that he's losing the grip. So that's why I don't buy that. But the way that this, if there are even two factions, but this first faction is prevailing, is the fact that, again, I was told yesterday that there is some kind of a ban and a blacklist on Grudinin on state television now. So he's not invited. He was everywhere on state television. Just a few weeks back. Now he's nowhere, so there will be no Grudinin for the next couple of weeks, and we'll see how that goes.
And this past week, some interesting pieces were popping up in the Russian press. And as Vismaya Gazeta had a piece saying that a lot of the rank and file was unhappy with Grudinin, and he was going to result in a schism in the party. Republic.ru had a piece saying that his candidacy could result in the further radicalization of the Communist Party. Now, I always interpret...
Radicalization?
Yeah, interesting. I mean, because those who are unhappy with them are going to be... I mean, it's the same argument, just phrased a different way, effectively. The radicals are going to... Because they're before all of this Grudinin business started, and Mark Eliotti, my regular co-host in this podcast, has brought this up, there are kind of there's talk in the Communist Party of, like, let's get rid of Zhuganov and let's have a real candidate who's younger and more aggressive, somebody more along the profile of Udaltsov. And actually, Udaltsov himself had come up as possibly that man. So the Grudinin phenomenon is both the result of dynamics within the Communist Party and between the Kremlin and the Communist Party.
Or maybe even more. One theory that I've heard in Moscow is that Zhuganov, because Zhuganov is so unappealing and is so old.
Putting it mildly.
and is kind of, he was there the same, you know, pretty much for the same time as Yavlinsky was. Last time when he ran in 2012, his numbers were unusually low and Zhirinovsky numbers were unusually high.
Yes.
So many people ditched Zhuganov and brought Zhirinovsky up.
Yep.
And that, again, that's what I'm told, is that this is actually, again, a cause of alarm within the presidential administration.
Right.
Because last Putin's term is all about resurgent nationalism. It's all about the war in Ukraine. It's all about Syria. It's all about this. It's all about anti-Americanism. So if to give Zhirinovsky's platform, a free pass, he can easily come second. Mm-hmm. And that will look bad on the Kremlin. They will look bad for, you know, for on many counts. So by nominating somebody who's not Zyuganov but who's much more energetic, they are propping up that candidate and actually decreasing the share that Zhirinovsky might get.
I mean, there is something to consider with the communists that's actually very important. They are the only force in Russia that can put massive... I mean, Navalny can put people on the streets, but the communists have a network nationwide that can put a lot of people on the streets when they want to. Now, they've been in the pocket of the regime forever, but they could. They are. This is another point Mark makes. They're potentially dangerous should things kind of go south.
Yeah, but usually communists were always in some sort of a arrangement with the Kremlin. So they never really opposed the power. Even when in 1996, where you know people thought that Zyuganov has really won the election, the Communist Party decided not to go with it further. And pretty much conceded. Mm-hmm. So they were very cautious in that way. So, but again, yeah, things may change. There is this new, because it's hard to underestimate how more radicalism appeared in Russia, both on the left-wing side and the right-wing mm-hmm. side over the past 6 years of Putin with all that resurgent nationalism. It may be a concern. So mm-hmm. there is a new generation, like you say, Udaltsov, and he's
who isn't
younger.
A communist party member, yeah. But they want somebody in that profile. There's a faction of the party that wants somebody in that profile.
Yeah, but those are people who can go to the streets, correct?
Yeah. Okay, before we move on to Navalny, just kind of briefly, you put all these pieces together. I mean, we seem to have nominally opposition candidates all basically doing a campaign advertisement for the Kremlin here, in one way, shape, or form or another. No, how would you put all these pieces of this puzzle together, or the behavior of the opposition?
This is not the election. They are playing, they are a part of
it's
the
a stage
troop.
Play.
They are part of the troop. And that's why, you know, when you have... the two main candidates are a strawberry tycoon and a Big Brother host. That's what you need to know about the Russian presidential election.
She is
election.
Bristling at that. She berated American journalists for calling her Russia's Paris Hilton. How dare they? But anyway, you're correct. And on that, and now we'll move on to the people who are taking part in the stage play to somebody who's trying to throw tomatoes at the stage play. In a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and take a look at that steamy video that Navalny released this week. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me here in the studio is veteran journalist and Kremlin watcher Kirill Suchotsky, executive editor for RFRL's Russian language program, Current Time. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical Podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at RFRL.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Это расследование мы сделали случайно.
Я хочу обратиться к Алексею Навальному.
Главная героиня сегодняшнего дня Настя Рыбка.
Девушка из белорусского Бобруйска.
С Дерипаской оказалось,
что Приходько прилетел на самолете Дерипаски.
So Alexei Navalny is not on the ballot, of course, but he is still very much a part of this campaign. In fact, he may be the only one who's acting like a candidate. And this week, he released another video documenting alleged corruption in high places. It featured Kremlin-connected oligarch Oleg Deripaska, Deputy Prime Minister Sergei Prikhodko, and on a yacht with a, as Navalny delicately put it, escort worker who calls herself Nastya Rybka. It was certainly one of Navalny's steamier and more entertaining exposés. What did you make of this, Kirill? It was fun to watch.
It was probably one of his best videos to date. Yeah. And generally, actually, you know, one of his most impactful was the one when he exposed Dmitry Medvedev.
Yeah.
But that may go further because it touches much more than just corruption. It's, on the one hand, it touches corruption. It's pretty much neutralized Deripaska. It's now kind of creating a question mark about Prikhodko, about the whole thing. But it also touches upon something completely different when Navalny sets a completely different stage. Is there a missing link between the Trump campaign and the Kremlin?
And quite frankly, it was tenuous the way it was. There was no smoking gun there.
No. But suddenly, you know, something that, you know, there was Paul Manafort discussed and there were briefings discussed and some, you know, that is something different. That's what the Washington Post
made a very powerful circumstantial case, especially when combined with the report in the Washington Post talking about the connections between Manafort and Deripaska.
Yeah, but this is all surreal farce. This is where, you know, it shouldn't be Navalny. It should have been Ksenia Sobchak hosting this whole thing. It's just, you know, and it's getting weirder and weirder, or like Alice in Wonderland would say, curiouser and curiouser with every passing hour. Because this morning, this Nastya Rybka, the escort girl,
started going back and forth on Twitter.
No. She started tweeting. She demanded from Oleg Deripaska to marry her, or she will accuse Deputy Prime Minister of Russia and other people from the administration president in gang rape. And this is something that is absolutely new in Russia. Then there was a book written by her where she actually, you know, she substituted the names, but they're clearly recognizable.
About this in the
they're
video.
Clearly recognizable, and Prihotka is like a daddy, yep. And one of the chapters, Papa, a daddy, and then or like a sugar daddy probably would be the right translation. And then there is the whole chapter called Sex with Daddy, Papa in sex. You know, how is the sex look
but
like?
The funny so thing is
it's,
when you...
it's something that is so unseen in Russia. It's very telling that this morning the head of the publishing house that published the book of Nastya Rybka, whom nobody's read that book. It was just it's still on sale
she
on the Russian.
Thanked Navalny on Twitter for helping her sales.
Yeah, I know. But the head of the publishing house resigned this morning, citing sudden illness.
Uh-huh.
He was in charge of that publishing house for 27 years, and suddenly overnight he got tired.
Now, for those who haven't seen this video in. Shame on you if you haven't. It's well worth watching. Just so everybody knows what we're talking about. Alexei Navalny released a video beginning with basically showing these scantily dressed women that kind of like invaded his electoral headquarters and did what looked like some kind of Kremlin orchestrated stunt. One of these women he identified as this Nastya Rybka, found her book and outlined and put the pieces together of this alleged yacht ride. It was very, very well documented, but I'm going to say alleged just to, you know, be careful, that had Prihotko and Deripaska and her and other escorts on the boat. Navalny makes the point that this is basically a bribe. It's a bribe of Prihotko, and then he later makes the connection between Deripaska and Manafort, and also Prihotko, by the way, is the foreign affairs advisor to the prime minister. So this is the whole context of this. What about Nastya Rybka is kind of a weird figure in more ways than one, a weird figure in this, because my assumption at the beginning was she was, you know, carrying the Kremlin's water by basically organizing that raid of Navalny's office.
No, and I think
she appears to be going rogue.
Yeah, she's going rogue, and I think she's fighting for her life now by being extremely public. There were more people that, you know, knew her apart from Deripaska and Prihotka, and probably those people do not want to be now in place of Deripaska. But it's very interesting, you know.
She's got good security.
Yeah, that's exactly what I mean. But there are very two telling things here that tells you all about the Russian state of power. You know, one is that, this was the escort woman, and she was Instagramming, but those people, Deripaska, Prihotka, were discussing state matters, were discussing Manafort, were discussing all these other things in presence of this escort girl.
Does that not strike you as weird and odd and unusual?
Because to them, because they're so super powerful that they just forget about this. They think that they're furniture.
Right.
Thought that they are talking just in presence of furniture who happened to be a woman, and then they couldn't even think that this woman may go and kind of document this or write something about this. That's one thing. And second is that the presidential administration, how many candidates or how much choice they had to raid Navalny's headquarters, you know, how many people they could send. And they sent this woman.
That's,
isn't this dumb?
Is this just a coincidence?
It's probably, it probably is, but that, you know, is it incompetence? Is it just something, you know, this is just, it strikes as completely either dumb or somebody is just trying to send a signal.
So it looks like Navalny may have legitimately dropped a major bomb here.
It could be.
This is interesting. Now, what is Navalny's game here? Is he just throwing tomatoes at the whole spectacle? Is he creating a counter spectacle? What is?
I think he's just trying to throw as many Molotov cocktails as he can. So he's just trying to his idea. This is not the election, and he is a disruptor. He needs to disrupt the system. He needs to make the system unstable. He needs to disrupt the election or disrupt the power. Because this system, which is in power in Russia, is so confident and stable and very much kind of grown into the fabric of the society that he believes that it needs to be disrupted. Genuinely, there is a legitimate cause for concern about corruption and, you know, all those allegations, but it's so bigger than this.
Mm-hmm. Now, every time I watch one of these exposés, the same question keeps coming to my mind, and this goes to the heart of Navalny's, I'll put it in quotes, relationship with the elite. The Kremlin has many towers, of course, right? Who on the inside, because what I keep asking myself is, somebody on the inside's got to be feeding him.
Somebody on the inside's
got to be feeding him. You don't. I mean, Navalny is a very intelligent man. He's an attorney by education. He's a good investigator in this sense. He certainly, his presentation is amazing. I'm envious of it as somebody that has to appear on media. But you don't get this kind of stuff without somebody on the inside.
No, somebody, and that's exactly what you said. Is that a coincidence? Is that a coincidence that that the same woman has been sent to raid Navalny's office, and maybe somebody tipped him off? You know, look at that woman, by the way. Is that something that's going on? You know, there are people who probably is within that state system, the state elite, who are not fans of that elite in the first place or hedging their bets in the second place.
Yeah, I've heard this, and again, I've articulated this thought on this program, that there are those, there's a theory out there that there are those on the inside, at the highest levels even, that would like to have somebody on the other side of the barricades to talk to just in case things go south. And Navalny is that man. I mean, it's not he's not in prison. Right, he's alive. You have to think he has a Caricia somewhere on the inside.
It may change again. You know that now it's there is not kind of a criminal case, but there are kind of charges. You know, not brought against him, but he's kind of questioned about his attack of the policeman during the last protest on January 28th, and the amateur video that we saw. It was quite a tussle between Navalny and his entourage and police during his detention. He was not arrested or something. He was let go, but now he's investigated whether he assaulted policemen. Those were exactly the charges that led to the Bolotnaya case in 2012. Protest. All the people who were imprisoned, they were convicted of attacking the policeman. Attacking the policeman meant, you know, removing. You know, I know one person who spent 3 years and 7 months in Putin's prison, who was convicted for removing a helmet from a policeman during that protest.
So this could be potentially serious, and this is something they're holding over.
Another sword on a very thin thread that will hang over him. But Navalny, to his credit, he many times showed then he's not intimidated by that. It was very interesting that when he was detained on January 28th, his tweet was very telling. He said, if they get me, you know, this is not about me, this is about you, and many people will stand in my place.
Well, this is almost a ritual now. You expect him to get arrested within minutes of stepping out of his flat to go to one of these demonstrations. I mean, regarding how Navalny has been not intimidated, but also kind of knowing the boundaries. I keep going back to that speech he made after the first round of the only round of the Moscow mayoral election back in 2013. Remember, when his supporters were on the streets, they thought they were robbed of getting to the second round. And, you know, there's ample reason to believe that may well be the case. And he said, I'm not going to ask you to torch cars. I'm not going to ask you to take to the streets. And when I do, I'll be with you. But trust me, I know what to do. And this suggested to me he was talking to people on the inside that he wasn't going to go.
And also, he's playing a long game. I mean, now it's not about it's not about this election. It's about the next one. It's about the next political cycle. And that's why he's smarter than some of the people who only thinks about this political cycle. Yeah. And many of them are candidates in this election. So he's thinking about the long game, you know, because, you know, that mayoral election, if, you know, people did start rioting and even people on the inside would not protect him and he will be jailed for quite a long time, that's when the whole thing stops.
Right.
And he's kind of, he's seeing a goal somewhere. So he's playing a long game where there could be short-term sacrifices, right, because there are long-term benefits.
No, my assumption about Navalny is all, you know, as they say in Russia, you don't seize power, you pick it up when somebody else drops it. And he's just positioning himself for when they drop it, and he wants to be the one that picks it up. Last thing I wanted to discuss about Navalny, of course, is the whole thing he's campaigning on now is a boycott. And there's been heated debate among the opposition about this, whether this is a good idea or not. Actually, Navalny's kind of on his own in terms of calling for this. Interestingly enough, the exact opposite position as he took in the 2011 State Duma elections. Remember, he said vote for anybody but United Russia, and Nemtsov was calling for a boycott of those elections. Dmitry Oreshkin had a very interesting piece in Snub doing the mathematics of a boycott, which are very interesting, that the places a boycott would work are places like Moscow and St. Petersburg, big cities where you're going to have an anti-Putin electorate anyway. So boycotting there is going to drive up Putin's numbers because the anti-Putin vote's not going to come out. And places like Chechnya and Dagestan, where you get, you know, 99% turnout and 99% of the vote, are going to be what they always are. So therefore, this is just going to drive Putin's total up without having a big effect on turnout. But Navalny, on the other hand, could argue, because turnout in Russian elections has been going down steadily, cycle after cycle after cycle, with a couple of blips. The Medvedev election was an interesting blip up. But other than that, it's been going down. So it's going to go down this time, unless they really fix it to get their 70-70 thing.
Yeah, and they could, but
but Navalny could claim, hey, see, my boycott worked.
Yeah,
going
but
down again.
It's kind of because boycott, and that's the whole incentive, the whole strategy for the Kremlin is not to vote for Putin, is to, but to vote for turnout. Because, and that's why they're making this election interesting, and that's why they're and by that they are urging people to come to the polling station. That's why there is Sobchak, that's why there is Grudinin. And many people who would have boycotted the election otherwise, even those who genuinely support Navalny, they will go and just show, okay, they will be persuaded to come and vote either for Grudinin or for Sobchak. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, that the boycott of election, opposition in this former Soviet countries have traditionally talked about boycott. Mm-hmm. You know, we've seen lots of boycott calls in Belarus over the past 20 years. It never brought any success.
So you think Navalny's strategy here is flawed?
No, it's not. It's not.
Or it's
flawed.
His only strategy.
Again, he's positioning himself not for this cycle. He's not thinking about this cycle. Then he's one of his points whenever it comes to the cycle that suits him, which may be the next, will be I didn't take part in this
in the forest. Know. Right, yeah. Right. It is harder to falsify turnout than it is to falsify results. That's true. So it's going to be interesting to see how far the Kremlin's going to be willing to go to falsify the turnout if there is a need.
No, but the turnout can, you know, it's interesting how, because Russia is so vast. And observers can be only that many in only that many places. And I remember during the last parliamentary elections, Reuters news agency, they sent reporters just to 3 or 4 polling stations in Bashkortostan, mm-hmm. where they found incredible, fixing operation mm-hmm. and stuffing the ballots and stuffing the turnout, not so the results, but the turnout, uh-huh. Stuffing. And then people said, oh, it's just, those 4 rogue polling stations that Reuters reporters were just so unlucky to pick. You know, everything else was fine. It's just this 4 right, polling station right. in Bashkortostan.
So they could finesse this, you're saying?
Yeah, yeah. I think I'm always remembered, my grandmother is from Belarus, but it's the same kind of thing. The same culture of election or fixing the election. She always comes to. She will be 90 very soon, but she is very politically active. And whenever she votes in the election, she comes to the polling station 15 minutes before polls close. And every single time, on paper, she's voted.
Uh-huh.
In pencil, And they said, "Oh, it's a mistake. It's a mistake. Of uh-huh. course, here's your ballot paper."
Well, it's a mistake, I believe, to call this an election, but it certainly is an interesting show. There's 1 month and 9 days to go, and it's probably going to continue to be a wild and wild, weird ride. And on that note, we'll wrap it up. That's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me here in the studio has been veteran journalist and Kremlin watcher Kirill Suchotsky, executive editor of RFRL's Russian language television program, Current Time. Thanks, Kirill, for an enlightening, lively, fun, and steamy conversation.
Thanks, Brian.
I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Kancheva, and my indispensable and totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, managing editor of RFRL's Russian language television program, Current Time, which, by the way, you can watch at www.currenttime.tv. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week, and now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.